So the reading I chose tonight is from Lumpu Siem. It's just a little book called Simply Soul. It's translated by Ajahn Jai Saro. And it was... was done around the time of his death, which was in 1992, I think. Right, it's around the same time because they were Yong Somchai, who lived at Wat Nanachat. She used to go to Lumpu Siem's as well. She'd known him for a long time, so she. Arranged for the book in Thai, and then some years later, she asked Ajahn Jai Saro to translate it into English. And there's a little bio here. Lumpu Siem Buddha Charo was born on the 26th of November 1909 in Sakonnakhon Province, northeast Thailand. His parents were farmers and dedicated supporters of the local monastery. At the age of 17, Lumpu Siem took novice ordination and shortly afterwards became a disciple of the great Ajahn Mun. Lumpu Siem stayed with Ajahn Mun and various of his senior disciples for many years, taking full ordination at the age of 20 at Wat Si Chandrawasa, Konkan. In later years, he has been the abbot of a number of monasteries in various parts of Thailand. Has given the ecclesiastical title of Prakru Santivaranyana in 1959. 1967, he established a monastery in the remote mountains of Qingdao in Chiang Mai province, and that has remained his residence until the present day. It's actually a very beautiful monastery. Qingdao is probably the tallest mountain in Chiang Mai province. I think there's others. There's taller mountains, but I don't think they're actually in Chiang Mai province themselves. But anyway, it's certainly one of the tallest, and it's got beautiful caves around it. And he lived in an area with forest and caves. he's quite... he had a... one of his notable distinctions in his teaching was he was one of the few Thai monks who emphasized sitting full lotus. And that was his kind of his calling card. He'd really get on everybody to be sitting in full lotus. I think I've told stories of when Ajahn Prabhakara went off to on Tudong and was living up in the north, and then he came back to Bung Wai, to Wat Nanachat, and he had been living with Lumpu Siem, and so he had the villagers said, you know, sit in full lotus, and because you got this one prat night, it's okay. Everybody said, you know, he sort of explained he'd been with Lumpu Siem, and Lumpu Siem really emphasized sitting full lotus, and he says, I'll show you how to do it. He puts us, get up in full lotus, and okay, everybody get in full lotus. So everybody goes in full lotus, you know, what's the big deal? They're sort of looking, the villagers, they're so used to sitting on the floor, that wasn't wasn't really an issue. Okay, this... is a talk that I thought it was because it's getting to the end of the winter retreat, and we've been having all of these readings from many different teachers, I felt that this had a it pulls a lot of strands together of the that are typical of the Thai forest tradition. It's titled Source and Stream. Now it is time for sitting meditation. Sit in the cross-legged posture. Place the right leg on top of the left leg and right hand on top of the left hand. Close your eyes and inwardly recite the mantra Buddho in conjunction with the breath. Concentrate the mind on Buddho. Sitting meditation is an important way of paying homage to the Buddha. The Buddha called all our former experiences, irrespective of their quality, presently existing thoughts of the past. Now, in this moment, do not allow such thoughts to preoccupy the mind. Let them all go. Concentrate the mind on the inner recitation of the mantra and bring the mind to peace in the present, in the immediate reality. It is the present moment that is important. Future matters, good and bad, all still lie ahead. For by definition, the future refers to things that have not yet taken place. The meditator must compose the mind on the present moment. If a thought surfaces in consciousness, simply remind yourself that it is just a thought of the past or a thought of the future, as the case may be. Don't add to or encourage such thoughts. Put good thoughts to one side for the time being, and the bad ones abandon altogether. Sitting here, our bodies are in a tranquil posture. The knowing is abiding within the heart, and each one of us is aware. This present knowing is our true mind. The conditioned mind of thought and proliferation is almost like a demon. Through its actions, external phenomena tend to become preoccupations, which then obstruct or destroy meditation. But if the meditator grounds himself in the present moment, then he is able to make use of the various meditation techniques. He may develop inner recitation, for example, or perhaps focus on parts of the physical body, such as head hair, body hair, nails, teeth, skin, sinews, and bones. When contemplation of the body ensues in perception of its unattractiveness or of its constituent elements of hardness, cohesion, temperature, and vibration, then that is meditation. When the mind is at peace in the recitation of Buddho, then that too is meditation. And the meditator is the mind. The mind itself has no color, shape, or form, but it has energy. It is our duty to let go of and abandon the conditioned, proliferating mind. But the mind of present knowing, that which concentrates on Buddha, listens to Dhamma, and reflects on its meaning, having been clearly observed, that true mind should be developed. In this case, to develop means to give care and attention to establishing it in peace. Peace comes by countering the outgoing stream of mentality and penetrating this present knowing. The normal, unrestrained mind is absorbed by the thought consciousness seeking distraction. Go against the stream by looking at the source of mental activity. It originates from this knowing. The source of the mind lies within us. However, this knowing is nothing substantial. It has no color, form, or shape in the way that material objects do. It is a formless element. To speak in terms of the five aggregates, there is rupa, these bodies of ours, vedana, the experience of objects as pleasant or unpleasant, comfortable or uncomfortable, sanya, discrimination based on memory, for example, that this is a human being and this is an animal, this is red, this is black, sankhara, conditioning mental activity, vijnana, cognition conditioned by mental activity. The four formless aggregates of vedana, sanya, sankhara, and vijnana arise within the knowing. The Buddha taught that during sitting and walking meditation, we should make the knowing converge on itself, not allowing it to go outwards. Thoughts of good and bad are all exterior matters and are endless. In thinking and cognizing, we must know the thinker, know the knower. All movement proceeds from this present knowing. That being the case, don't be deceived by these expressions of mind. They are merely shadows, flitting off into the past and future, thinking about and elaborating on the things that we like and the things that we don't. This proliferation is what conditions the mind. What is it that knows the true mind, and what is it that knows the conditioned mind? It is just this one single knowing, the same thing that hears the sound of the discourse and meditates on Buddho. As there is just this single knowing, muster your energies and vow to yourself, I will not indulge the thinking mind. I will gather the mind into itself. Not allowing the mind to wander means that it stays with Buddho. All you have to do then is to maintain Buddho. Buddho is the name of the fully enlightened one and should be reflected on. That we have come into contact with Buddhism, with Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and that we have come to practice is due to the Buddha. The Buddha, after realizing supreme enlightenment, gave to the world the teachings of Dhamma Vinaya that we call Buddhism. The great teachers of old and the four assemblies of Buddhists have carried on the study and practice of the teachings right up until the present time. In Thailand today, everywhere we go, we see monasteries, monks, novices, eight precept laymen and laywomen, and householders with faith and inspiration in Buddhism. This is all thanks to the Buddha. It has been a long time, over 2,500 years, since the Buddha entered final Nibbana. Even so, the Dhamma and Vinaya, the teachings and the ordinances based on the 5, 8, 10, and 227 precepts still remain. We bring the virtues of the Buddha to mind in order to be able to take him as an example in our practice. Where did the Buddha come from? He came from the mind that resolved on Buddhahood and wished to ferry all beings to Nibbana. From the moment of his initial resolve, in whatever realm the Buddha to be was born into, then whenever he performed acts of charity, refrained from unvirtuous actions and speech, or practiced meditation, then Buddhahood was always his motivation. Whenever he was born as a human being, he accumulated virtue. Eventually, the power of goodness created by his dana, sila, and bhavana, the baramis, the perfections that he had developed, were strong enough for him to become Buddha. Now, in recollecting the Buddha, we take his virtues as our object. Buddho refers to the Lord Buddha, and the one who inwardly recites Buddha is just this mind. It is just this mind that recites Buddho, knows the breath, and is aware, while doing so, that one is creating virtue. This mind has always been here. The knowing has been born into the world countless times. But because ignorance and craving have overwhelmed it, our dana, sila, and bhavana have been insufficient to free us from the mass of suffering with which the human organism is fraught. So we must muster our energy with firm resolve, taking meditative calm as our foundation. The principles that will lead us out of this world and the mass of suffering are those of samatha and vipassana meditation. The mind must be firmly one-pointed, tranquil, cool, and at ease with samatha before vipassana is feasible. If the mind is still in movement, drifting and infirm, still not tranquil and motionless or one-pointed, it is impossible for understanding of the nature of things to take place. Take as example the founder of our religion, the fully self-enlightened Buddha. Before his enlightenment, he practiced calm meditation, using the breath as his initial object. On the day of his enlightenment, he practiced this way. On the in-breath, he focused intently on the in-breath. On the out-breath, he focused intently on the out-breath. All mental agitation and movement ceased, leaving only the in-breaths and out-breaths remaining. The Lord's mind was focused intently on the breath until his mind became calm, cool, and easeful, attaining the firmness of kanika, upachara, and ultimately the unwavering apana samadhi. When the Buddha to be is mine was thus unwaveringly and undeviatingly single-pointed, vipassana took place. There was clear knowing of the body and mind as impermanent, of all beings and phenomena as transitory. He saw the suffering inherent in being born with a body and mind, and he saw selflessness. He realized that the perception of an abiding self is based on delusion. In order to clearly know these three characteristics of anicchang, dukkang, and anatta, the mind must be firm. Thus, the effort to bring the mind to a secure and steadfast tranquility, not allowing it to become fascinated by forms, sounds, odors, flavors, physical sensations, and mental phenomena, is the essence of meditation techniques, and something we must all develop. Take care when the eyes see forms, not to let the mind waver. Keep up the inner recitation of Bhutto. Take care not to be deluded when hearing sounds. Beautiful or ugly sounds are all just worldly conditions. Maintain the mind's firmness. The pleasant and offensive odors that contact the nose, know them. Don't be deceived by them. No matter how delicious the taste of the food on the tongue, remain equanimous. Be impassive to the various physical sensations, whether hot or cold, hard or soft. This is the supreme practice in Buddhism. So gather your energies and establish the mind in the present moment. In general, meditators' minds are not unified and tranquil in the present moment. They are wandering up ahead and back behind, taking up external matters concerning other people and dwelling on them, finding pleasure and satisfaction in agreeable mental states. They are caught up entirely in superficialities. Although the mind of simple knowing is already present within us, unless we bring it to the fore through meditation, we will be unable to perceive the truth of suffering. When suffering arises in the body, contemplate it so that the mind will accept it for what it is. When physical illness occurs, the grasping mind starts clinging to the idea of being ill. In fact, it is the earth element that is unwell. If the meditator's mind is stable and clearly sees the three characteristics, he will simply regard illness as an affair of the elements. He knows that the mind is formless and not subject to such pains. It is due to clinging to the idea of self, and that the body belongs to self, that mental suffering arises. In fact, this body is merely elements, and it is the elements that are sick. It is the earth, water, fire, and air elements that are disturbed. If one can separate things in this way, then the mind rests at ease. Whatever occurs in the physical body, there's no clinging to it as belonging to self. It is seen as simply a matter of elements, a matter of anicchang, dukkang, anatta. It is just the nature of things. The present knowing knows clearly, truly, and constantly. The mind is cool, no longer hot with clinging. Suppose someone harshly scolds or maligns us, even if they abuse us right to our faces. If we don't cling, it ends right there. What has arisen passes away. But if the knowing is misled, it grasps at this body and mind as being self. When someone speaks to us harshly, we get angry. That's nothing to do with me. Due to clinging, there is me and mine. It is just this clinging that is the cause of suffering, agitation, turmoil, and disease. The Buddha taught us to let go of all external affairs during meditation. Whatever physical or mental distress arises is just the suffering of the aggregates. Don't let the knowing suffer. Meditate in order to attenuate the defilements of greed, hatred, and delusion, and ultimately bring them to an end. When the knowing is still deluded and clings to the idea of self, to me and mine, then it takes birth. Perhaps it becomes an animal, a human being, a celestial being, Indra or Brahma, God. But whatever it becomes, it suffers just in being that. As long as there is still clinging to the elements and aggregates, to name and form, and there is no awareness of the way to abandon defilements, then there is suffering in the world. The five aggregates are classified as suffering in the world. For when one clings to them as me and mine, then right there the mass of suffering appears. We sit right in the pile of suffering, in the midst of the fire of craving, hatred, and delusion. The fire flares up and constantly burns our heart. We are meditating now so as to gather the mind into the knowing, in order to put out the fires that are burning our hearts. Don't harbor the fire of anger. Abandon it. There's no need to get angry with anyone. If you feel any jealousy or ill will towards anyone, give it up. Don't allow the mind to indulge in it. This is cleansing the knowing both day and night, whether standing, sitting, walking, or laying down. It is not clinging to me and mine. The aggregates do not belong to anyone. They are something natural to the world. As soon as the knowing is born with a name and form, it tends to grasp onto that name and form as self. But can that name and form last indefinitely? If it could, nobody would die. Nobody would become ill. Nobody would experience pain or get old, because the aggregates would do what they were told. It is because the aggregates don't do what they are told that the Buddha taught us not to cling to them, but to see them clearly with penetrative wisdom. If there is no clear seeing, then there is suffering. So don't be fooled into clinging onto things. It is suffering in the world. When the knowing no longer clings, it is empty. It is in meditation. It is cool and at ease. All the different kinds of mental turmoil come from delusion. The agitated striving mind that wants to possess, wants to get, wants to be. In other words, the mind of craving. Get rid of craving and clinging from the mind. Try to prevent anything from accumulating in this knowing. Make the present knowing radiant and pure. Meditate. Firmly ground the mind. Gather the knowing onto itself and abandon the condition of externals. Let the knowing dwell in the heart. Whatever the posture of the body, let the knowing know itself at all times. If an evil thought arises, abandon it. If goodness occurs, develop it. And here, the goodness we resolve to develop is exemplified by the mantra Buddho. We develop it or concentrate on it internally so as to make the mind cool and happy. We prevent agitation and distress with the elements and aggregates, with the bodies and minds of other people. We don't allow them inside. When the mind is thus cool and at ease, it is said that Buddho is dwelling in the heart. In other words, the knowing lies within. To produce this firm and enduring tranquility, you must go against the stream and enter within. Then you will understand the practice of Dhamma with the mindfulness and wisdom that are present in the heart. If there is no countering the stream and no entity within, the search for virtue externally is an endless one. Truth and virtue do not lie beneath the land or sea, or in the sky or in space. They lie in volitions, the mind that makes effort to give up evil and do good. When the mind converges, right here it becomes spacious, cool, and easeful. It is established in Dhamma practice. Sitting there is meditation in the sitting posture. Standing, there is meditation in the standing posture. Walking, there is meditation while walking. And lying down, there is meditation until one falls asleep. As soon as we wake, we continue the inner recitation of Buddho, making Buddho our constant concern. Wherever the mind goes, we don't follow it. We give up all the going and settle for dwelling. The knowing lies right here within us. Everything else is merely a passing affair. The truth lies with the knowing. Clearly observe that since our birth into this world, the knowing has dwelt in the body. Wherever we go, the body goes too. The knowing cannot escape from the body and mind. It drags the body with it here and there. When we sit, it is the body that sits, and when we lie down, it is the body that lays down. And so the knowing is deceived into attaching to that name and form, to the provisional realities of the world. Not comprehending the way to withdraw from them and put them down, the defilements of greed, hatred, and delusion steadily accumulate. So in studying Buddhism, whether it's the Dhamma or the discipline, whatever method it is being taught by, having studied, we must put those teachings into practice. We must compose this knowing firmly on itself. Keep the mind within. Don't allow it to wander about and become fascinated with sentient beings and the material world through delusion and unclear seeing. Resolve to put forth effort. Aspire to rid yourself of defilements. Greed, hatred, and delusion all lie here within the mind, so put effort into abandoning them just here. Be vigilant and care for the mind right here. Recite Buddho right here. Compose the knowing. When we have established the knowing in this way, then in whatever posture we are in, there is constant meditation. Sitting here, we can inwardly recite Buddho, undistracted and undeceived by external matters. We have been deluded by the external world for countless lifetimes. Let us not be deluded by it anymore. Yes.
There was a reference at one point to the four somethings of Buddhism. I forget now what the noun was. The four, it wasn't traditions, but I had the sense that the four...
Yeah. Let me see what they call it. It's the... four assemblies. Four assemblies of Buddhas. Bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, upasakas, upasikas. Traditional four assemblies.
Over one's disciples, were there certain disciples that were renowned for wisdom, others for samadhi, others for determinations like powers, faith, and so on?
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm not... I'm not 100% certainly. I would think that, say, like Lungta Mahabhu would be on the wisdom side, and I'm not that like Lumpu Chop was considered the great Dutanga monk. Trying to think of others. If there was any special qualities that were pointed out.
Was it work out? Determination? Or?
Maybe, yeah. Yeah, he's probably held up as being determination would have been Lumpu Khao's, because he was he ordained in later life, and then put forth a tremendous amount of effort to practice.
Ajahn Jeff said that Ajahn Lee was reputed to be foremost in samadhi. Uh-huh. Ajahn Mun's disciples.
Uh-huh.
I heard that Ajahn Mun Chai was like of Lungta Mahabhu's disciples, the foremost in analyzing dependent origination.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Who's that monk who's like, you said something about military planes were flying around and he was like flying in the air or something?
Lumpu Wan. He was a pretty quiet monk. He got a reputation because he was pilots from the Thai Air Force noticed him up above the but I think it was the other way around. I think he was curious about what these planes were doing, and went out to check it out.
I heard something about it was on an airplane and became curious about the engine, and it started messing with the engine and had to ask him to stop.
Oh, that was Ajahn Fun. It was on a bus. And he'd never been on a bus before, never been on a vehicle. She said, "How?" He started thinking. He was concentrating. He started, how do these things work? And it goes, he put his mind on it, and then it, and then he withdrew his mind. They sort of got it going again. He's sitting on the bus. And, how do these things work? What is this, really fascinating? Says that happened 3 times, and he figured, oh, I better not mess with this, because he was trying to figure out the engine and putting his mind to it, and sort of just shut the whole thing down.
He was interfering with the spark plug.
He was sort of seeing the spark plug.
He pretty strongly stressed the idea that you have to perfect your samatha before you can do vipassana. And I'm wondering if that is a pretty strictly held teaching in this tradition?
It is, but it also, what he's emphasizing is, of course, the tranquility comes through the steadiness of the attention on the knowing, so like not letting the mind go out, and that. So generally, once you start questioning the monks, they're not talking about you got to get to this stage or that stage before. They're talking, the mind becomes settled when you bring the attention to that quality of knowing, and then whatever your past accumulations are, then your mind will sort of settle to a particular degree. But the emphasis is on that directing attention to that quality of knowing and awareness, and not being distracted by the different thought processes. So that, and then also that that quality of firmness is what is emphasized, so that the mind becomes steady and firm, as opposed to, because it's a language thing as well, because especially in English, when you talk about concentration, and there's an image that comes up from that, and what the teachers are tend to be putting to, how do you make the mind firm and steady, as opposed to concentrated and kind of this, because even the what's called one-pointed is remember Ajahn Chah saying, they use the word in the description of concentration or of samadhi, that there's a one-pointed mind, but the qualities of the one-pointed mind actually have vitakka, vichara, piti, sukha, ekakata. How can that be one-pointed if it's got all these things in it? And he said, and it's not that it's one-pointed excluding, it works together, it harmonizes. It's balanced. So that's the steadiness comes from the balance, and where those those different factors of mind are actually functioning together so that the mind becomes clear and awareness stands out, becomes bright.
That when Lumpur was talking about investigating nama-rupa, and I've heard that before, is that looking at the fundamental movement of mind towards like unwholesome dhammas, like name and form, whereas like understanding the mind is discriminating towards like dhamma-vichaya, you know, kind of looking at this is like that, kind of, that's more of the wholesome factor, or?
Can be. I mean, it depends on what the tone is. Because if the tone is restless, it's more that, which is again sort of paying attention to the quality of mind. So, but nama and rupa is just sort of like, mind and body, and just sort of simplifying things so that one is seeing things in that light and not looking at it in terms of a me, a mine, something that's a problem per se, and it's something, there's just these functions of nature, these aspects of nature.
What happened to
Mechi
Songjai?
What happened?
I just saw her in December. She's around. She's spending most of her time around Bun Lom. I think it was most of her time is around there, and mostly around Bun Lom. She's got a couple different, few different places that she goes to. Keep trying to get her to come to America. She's too far, too old. But she's been saying she's too old for like 15 years now. it's starting to move in that direction. She's very solid. Former university professor, taught biology. She studied in America. She did graduate work in, I think, Denmark as well. Right around the time that Lumpur was up at Thamsang Phet, I think, is when she packed in her academic career and came to the monastery. June came a couple of years later. Another Upasika, very dedicated. She worked for the Konkan University.
I was with her in the same office, yes.
Yeah, you worked with her. So it was a... what was the institute you worked for?
I don't remember. It's funded by USAID and Canada.
Right.
The money come from Canadian government and USAID.
It's more like a research institute for rural development.
Yes, and run by the prince of Thailand, Ajahn Kim. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's really. And June was there for probably 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And she said she's leaving.
She said she's leaving, yeah. Okay.